Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your guest host, Manny Acutiel. That's me. Every Monday night, State of the Bay is live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Tonight, I'll be sitting down with San Francisco reporters to discuss San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie's first 100 days. How is he doing? How is the city doing? Our media roundtable will take stock of his brief tenure as mayor and take your questions. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Manny Acutiel. But first, Daniel Lurie hit the ground running with the new government structure, new civic partnerships, a new social media strategy, and some splashy new plans around homelessness and housing construction. Now that he has been in office for over 100 days, how is he doing? He's got a lot of energy, but he's facing a lot of headwinds too. Tonight, we're going to dive into all of this with our esteemed panel of guests who are all following Lurie's administration closely. State of the Bay stalwart, Joe Eskenazi.
Thanks for having me.
He's the managing editor and columnist of Mission Local. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Joe.
Great to be here.
We've got J.D. Morris, City Hall reporter of the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, J.D.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And finally, we have Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, the one and only politics reporter from the San Francisco Standard. Welcome, Joe.
Yo and yo.
So a bit of housekeeping before we start. We have two Joes on the panel. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to identify the Joes, but maybe also if you're a Joe, mm-hmm. say you're Joe before. Like, we're going to try to not confuse the listeners too much.
Identify your flavor of Joe.
Exactly. Are you the better Joe or the worst Joe?
Whoa.
Definitely the older Joe.
Wow.
Yeah. I wasn't going to say it.
I don't know who's the older Joe. I can't tell. If you have questions or comments for our media roundtable about Mayor Lurie, the good, the bad, or just the curious about something, email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or call us at 866-798-8255. That is, because I did it wrong, 866-798-8255. I'm very glad that I had a speech therapist in second grade because I had a lisp and I don't anymore, I hope. This is also an opportunity for you, listeners, to have access to these journalists. And what journalists we have here, holy moly mackerel. These are like the three tippy-top journalists in the city. This is really exciting.
No pressure.
Yeah, I know. God, I have Joe Fitz, I've got Joe Eskenazi and J.D. Morris. What questions, what answers, what joy and what wisdom we will gain. The purpose of today is to talk about Mayor Lurie's 100 days. So first, I would love to just start kind of high level. How do you think he's doing? Just like right there, your first thought, 100 days in, how is Mayor Lurie doing? Let's start with the most senior most reporter we have here, Joe Eskenazi.
Well, the dumbest person I ever worked with in newspapers used to always tell us that perception is reality. And in this case, he was correct. And Mayor Lurie is definitely, the vibes are different. And we can parse the substance of what's different, and we can go over the things that he's doing that would have happened anyway, or plans that were already in the works that he's now jumping on board with. But there is a different vibe. You know, people who work in City Hall are not worried about having an angry phone call and being berated while somebody's like pedaling on a Peloton and giving them the third degree. That's not how he runs the railroad here. And people in San Francisco, you know, whether it's statistically they should be or shouldn't be, you know, probably are more forgiving and feeling more optimistic about things. And vibes matter. You know, vibes matter more than policy probably to people when they're figuring out who to vote for. Mm. And so why wouldn't it be the case? At my most cynical, I would say that the city's policy right now is to move drug users off the street so we can put drunks onto the street. But you know what? Vibes matter. And that means that somebody who comes onto the street is going to say, I went to a party and it was fantastic, instead of guess what I saw and it was horrible. And that will matter in getting more people and more businesses to come to San Francisco, even though it may not be the ultimate solution to our problems and it may not even be the most substantive solution. These kinds of things matter. So on the vibes, much better.
Mm. What do you guys think?
Well,
Joe Fitz
here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, the funny part about the vibes is I think Daniel Lurie would agree. I mean, he said as much when, you know, I spoke to him. We each had our 100-day interviews with Lurie, like, how are you at 100 days? And he said as much to me. He's like, I know that we have all these stats that are saying, you know, this is down and that is down and this is better and that is better. Mm-hmm. But when you ask Lurie directly, how do you know your job is done? He'll tell you when people tell me they feel safe, they feel good, they feel happy. And what he's doing is going towards that. Something I wish I could measure more easily is his Instagram presence and how much that's affecting things. But everyone I talk to seems to say, wow, Lurie's everywhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because I see him on the gram.
Yeah, I want to get to that. There's a lot in there. But JD, just high level, how do you think the mayor's doing after 100 days?
You know, honestly, I don't know that I have a lot to add to that. I think, you know, when you asked the question, the first word that came to my mind was vibes. So wow. I'm encouraged to hear my colleagues here use the same one. But like Joe Eskenazi was saying, vibes do matter. I think he had this one piece of legislation that he passed that he calls a fentanyl emergency ordinance. I don't call it that because it's not really technically a state of emergency, but we can get into that later. But it was an opportunity where I think he didn't really have to compromise. He could have just said my way or the highway on that. But he actually like took amendments from supervisors that might think a little differently than him politically. And I think they certainly really appreciated that. Mm-hmm. The people on the board of supervisors, I think, you know, folks throughout San Francisco City Hall right now feel like they're getting a really good vibe from him and like they have an open door with him and they can talk to him. So he has a lot of political capital built up. And he hasn't really had to spend it in a huge way yet or do something super controversial that's going to piss a lot of people off. But I think that's coming.
Oh, it's definitely coming because the budget is coming. I mean,
exactly.
You know it's coming. Daniel Lurie, throughout his professional life, has been giving people money to make things happen. And now his job is going to be taking people's money away. It's going to be very difficult. And so, you know, we are very much in the salad days right now. This is the very early innings.
So let's talk about that because I've had friends text me and they're like, oh, this mayor's awesome. Like, it's so great. Did you see his Instagram account? Like, he's so cool. He is everywhere. And I think a lot of us who've worked in politics in the city know that it's impossible for the honeymoon period to last forever. So what do you think will be that moment where the rubber will meet the road a little bit on the city? And you've mentioned the budget already. And how do you think he'll fare when that happens?
Yeah, well, you know, the budget is one thing, but even before that, he's backed this kind of new zoning plan that's going to, you know, have some zoning changes on the west side of the city, up zoning the city. That's already a little bit of a, you know, the kids are in the back going, oh, no, we need out in the back of the car at this point. These are people who backed Daniel Lurie. These are people who liked Daniel Lurie. And they're having like incredibly heated debates on the next door machine right yeah. now about whether or not they still do like him.
Okay, so the zoning map.
I feel like the zoning map that they put forward is as aggressively upzoning as London Breed would have done and maybe a little bit more. On the other hand, you know, within the Chronicle article about it that your colleague J.K. Dineen wrote is a quote that I think is very telling from the head of the Residential Builders Association, which says that San Francisco doesn't have a zoning problem. It's that the people who build houses are building elsewhere and there isn't money and it's not working out. You know, it's almost if you offered me I could buy a mansion for several million dollars, it's like, well, I can't do it. You know, even if it's 1/10 the price it should be, I'm just not capitalized. I can't do it. Mm. So to me, that zoning plan right now, at least, feels like you need to have insurance. So I have a piece of paper that says I have insurance, even though it's not really going to pay out. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But it can make people angry, especially people on the west side, as Joe mentioned. But, you know, there's a lot of time between him having to go and ask for a vote again.
Right. And what about the budget for a second? I mean, the budget process starts when? And what's the mayor's role in it? And how do we think he's going to fare in that process?
So he has to turn something in on June 1st. That'll be his budget proposal. As Joe Eskenazi here is careful to remind us every year, the mayor controls the overwhelming majority of San Francisco's budget. The Board of Supervisors gets to tinker around the edges with just a teeny, teeny, tiny little slice. So on June 1st, you're going to see Daniel Lurie present his city spending plan for the next 2 years that is expected to close something like an $820 million deficit. What he has told us so far is that, you know, I think he said on his first day in office, the era of Band-Aid solutions is over. And what he meant by that was that, you know, we've had these deficits for several years now. Every year, they've been closed for the most part using a lot of one-time money, temporary money. But the shortfall that we have is an ongoing one. And so he has been sending signals that he wants to do something a little more ambitious there, but we don't fully know what that's actually going to look like yet. And, you know we'll see when the rubber meets the road.
I don't think they do either, honestly.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think they do
this
either.
Close,
I do not.
It's mid-April.
You know, that's I don't think that they have the plans in place yet. That's not to say that they won't. By law, they have to, but I don't get
Why?
The feeling.
Why do you think that?
I just do not get the feeling that anybody has put their finger on this, and I also don't think that – I think it's more of a moving target. It could always get worse. You
right.
know, you need contingency plans for if and when Trump comes after San Francisco, you know, and on a whim, you know, decides to cut off hundreds of millions of dollars or just stiff us for things that, you know, that are already paid for. Mm. So, you know, I do worry about that. But, you know, come what may, it's going to happen. Keep in mind, Daniel Lurie won without labor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, governing without labor is not the same as politics without labor, but he doesn't owe labor much. And so this is going to be a different budget process than if any of the other candidates had won.
Well, one of the reasons that he's, you know, sounding the alarm on making those actual cuts is the threat to our coffers is huge from Trump. When talking to Lurie and seeing some memos that they're preparing, the amount of money that Trump could impact directly, that's not even talking indirectly, but just directly, is in the realm of like busting more than like $1.3 billion. Like it would bring our deficit up to about $2 billion or pushing $2 billion. That's a ton of money. That's far more than we can handle, even though it sounds like we have a lot with a 15-plus billion-dollar budget. A lot of that is not money that we can actually touch. A lot of that is stuff that passes through the city.
Yeah, well, okay, so all three of you have spent considerable time with the mayor, interviewing him, writing about him. You mentioned it's a lot harder to defy labor as someone that's already in government. But also, you mentioned that when he was going through the kind of the fentanyl emergency ordinance, he showed a desire to actually, he's been more amenable towards working with different parties, making amendments, changing his plans, right? He didn't just kind of bluster through and do his own thing. I guess the question is, now we have Mayor Lurie. Now we have a billion-dollar budget hole. Do we think we're going to get someone who is going to make enemies because he is going to have to make real cuts to real aspects of what we do? Or do you all predict that you're going to have a mayor who's going to try to make as many people happy as possible?
Both of those things can be true. You don't have to be malicious about it, but you're going to make somebody upset. And, you know, by definition, you're going to make lots of people upset because you're going to be taking away money. Something that Daniel Lurie is emboldened to do is not only to tweak with labor, but to tweak with nonprofits. And, you know, if it's politically advantageous to just take money away from nonprofits, it's also unfortunately politically advantageous to take money away from them all and, you know, make them all, you know, let God sort them out as far as who is a beneficial nonprofit and who isn't. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely people will be upset. The question is it going to be people that in the long run matter? And we'll see about that.
Well, and Manny, you know, it's not even what you do sometimes. It's how you do it.
Mm.
Like instead of hearing about these cuts at the last second or having them foisted on the supervisors in public, they're reading about it when they go online and check the news. Instead, he's actually walking to their offices. I think he told me he's walked to the supervisors' offices more than 20 times. I asked, you know, different supervisors.
This matters.
Yeah,
it's a huge thing.
They
yeah,
care. That's what I was getting at earlier. They really care about this stuff.
Yeah, I was like asking like different supervisors, like how often did London Breed walk into your office? You, the answer is, unsurprisingly, zero. It's none.
What do you think that's actually about? Do you think it's just his personality? He's just a more collaborative person. Do you think it's because he didn't get anyone's endorsement and support, and so he feels like he is trying to earn that now? Is it that he like what is it actually about? Is it
I don't
political.
Think Daniel Lurie has to play act at being, you know, a menschy guy. But, you know, I mean, the amount that it seems to matter that he walks in and treats people, you know, in a nice way is almost a little bit embarrassing, to tell you the truth.
Embarrassing for who?
I mean, that like, you know, he came to my office and he talked to me. It's like, you know, you have an office, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like he had to cross a fjord to do this, you know. Like, it's on the other side of the building, but, like, it matters. And it's just, you know, it's important to people that it's a frank discussion and that it's done in a civil way. And you know, that's a low bar, but he's surpassed it, you know, easily.
Okay, so let's get to vibe. Let's go back to vibes for a second. You mentioned Instagram.
Yeah.
And it has been talked about a lot, how he's using Instagram, moving around, going to lots of different local businesses. It seems to be a very intelligent way to direct his message directly to the people. I think he has over 50,000 followers already. He started with none. Mm-hmm. So how would you evaluate his use of social media, and how do you think it's affecting his ability to actually govern as a mayor?
I do worry about his caffeine intake, to be quite honest with you. Like,
well, you're not seeing him drink coffee at all these, just buying coffee.
People write to me about it, and would you believe this type situation? I don't think anyone's going to not vote for him because of his behavior on Instagram. So I think it's a net plus.
I always find it interesting to hear from my friends who don't follow politics at all, who just like don't, who could not tell you the members of the Board of Supervisors, you know, which I would imagine are most people. And they're like, wow, that's Daniel Lurie. He is everywhere, isn't he? And I just hear that again and again and again, because it does give you this feeling that he's just everywhere in the city all at once.
It very much adds to, I would say, a vibe of omnipresence. But what I would point out is that he's sort of trying to mix like what I would characterize as food influencer kind of posts and city boosterism posts with, like, you'll see on his Instagram, like him walking down 6th Street, right, or being at 16th and Mission, right, like being physically present in these spaces where I think some of San Francisco's most serious and urgent problems are playing out. And so I think it just adds to the vibes that we've been talking about, where people feel like, okay, he's working on it.
It does kind of feel like it's a little bit of like eating your vegetables. It's like fun, 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 really, really depressing, fun, 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 really, right, depressing.
But also keep in mind that, you know, we've talked a lot about vibes, and I imagine that, you know, some of the more ardent folks at home are that's grinding their gears a bit. But it is important that Daniel Lurie is not denigrating San Francisco for political gain. That shouldn't have been an issue, but it was. And you know, the mayor herself was denigrating San Francisco for political gain until it wasn't convenient.
Right.
And certainly Mark Farrell was doing that. And, you know, this, in the end, didn't work out. Daniel Lurie, for the flaws he has, never did this. And right, that's, again, a low bar that he has surpassed. He is not going to push the city's head into the toilet in order to make political points.
Right. Well, let's get to probably the issue that's most top of mind for most San Franciscans, which is public safety, at least. And it's something that Daniel Lurie ran on, clean streets, safe streets. How would you evaluate how he's done? How concrete have his plans been? And in the first 100 days, what achievements can you point to that he's made on this particular issue, if at all?
I think this is one of the more problematic ones, because public safety in San Francisco, this is where vibes isn't enough. Public right, safety was already on the way down. The handy-dandy chart in the Chronicle showed a precipitous drop in violent crime starting in 2023. So, you know, I'm glad that this is the case. I'm happy that San Francisco is one of the safest mid-sized to large cities. But it's hard to point to anything and say, this is why. A lot of the things that police were doing, they were doing before.
What, JD or Joe Fitz, what do you have to add? Also, anything that in your reporting you found that maybe contradicts what Joe just said?
Well, the one thing that often comes up when you ask people about this is that there are the police statistics, which are very useful for measuring things like car break-ins, which we did a story, my colleagues did one, I think it was last week, you know, car break-ins in San Francisco were at like a 22-year low in 2024. But then there's just sort of the general disorder, the scenes of people dealing and using drugs on the streets, people who are mentally ill kind of wandering around, all of that can add up to a picture in people's minds of feeling unsafe that isn't necessarily reflected in those statistics. And so I think what you do see from him is certainly trying to address the latter in a very heavy way right now. You know, one of the first things he did was try to do more police enforcement on 6th Street and mm-hmm. SoMa, but then he's kind of immediately was forced to deal with the consequences of that, which is that, you know, it ended up displacing a lot of activity into the Mission, specifically to 16th and Mission, not too far from Manny's, obviously. I live around there as well. I've seen it. And then, you know, after that, he had to roll out a police van to the 16th and Mission BART Plaza, which is now there indefinitely.
Someone has defaced that van with a really? Word that I won't say on the radio.
Oh, no.
But you know, I again, you don't want to be cynical for the sake of being cynical, but I have seen the internal email that the police put out in order to solicit overtime officers who are earning overtime every day but Wednesday to be in that van. And it says, the first thing it says, your number one job is to keep people from vandalizing the van.
Right.
Which is an interesting thing to think about. You, again, Manny, you worked there. Manny's is at 16th and Valencia. When you have an overwhelming police presence on 16th Street Plaza, wrongdoing and people who are just desperate go elsewhere. And so the people who are on the alleyways near there, a lot of them are afraid to come out of their homes. And a lot of the people who were, you know, pushed out in at 6th Street, you know, ended up in the Mission. And where will they go next? Mm. And this is what's known as hotspot policing. And, you know, certainly, you know, the solution isn't, well, you should do nothing. But right. You can't solve the problem this way. And this is what, you know, in our interview with the mayor, he kept saying that they would follow them wherever they went in town. That's reactionary. That's following. You know, this is a problem that you are not getting in front of by definition.
Right.
So, like, that's challenging.
Right.
Well, it is representative of both Daniel Lurie's strong suits and his weak suits, that whole debacle of moving folks, the drug deals and the whole drug crisis from 6th Street to the Mission. Because on the one hand, you know, he owned it. He said, you know what, this happened. I'm going to put folks out in the Mission. I'm going to react with police. He wasn't like some past mayors and tried to put it off on the Board of Supervisors or on some other entity. He was like, no, we tried to take an action. It didn't quite work. People went over to the Mission. Now we're going to deal with it here. But on the other hand, he's fairly new to this. And any one of us sitting at this table could have told you that moving people from 6th Street was going to have a whack-a-mole effect and push people to another part of the city, because we've seen it for decades.
And this is where we have to start wondering, what is the goal here? Because the police and then later the mayor tub-thumped the pre-dawn raid at Market and Van Ness. And, you know, they had these get tough images where, you know, you have people, you know, huddled on the ground, you know, illuminated by red, white and blue flashing lights. It turns out that they didn't charge anybody. They right. didn't charge anybody. They arrested 40 people and didn't charge anybody. And, you know, people who live 100 yards away tell me they're all here now and they're in a residential area. So that makes it worse. Mm. And on top of that, an assistant district attorney told all of the gathered people at Tenderloin Station, my colleague Eleni Balakrishnan covered this. She said, you know, you need to establish probable cause. She kept making it sound as if they didn't establish probable cause, which is a problem. You can't arrest people without probable cause.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not like the journalists are pushing for these arrests to happen. But I think what we're saying is, if you're going to do it for a reason.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess the question is, when I interviewed him last week or 2 weeks ago, he said the same thing, that we're going to be relentless, that we're going to show people that it's no longer okay to be in San Francisco and to deal drugs and to commit crimes. Isn't being more persistent with arrests and I guess it sounds like badgering people enough, moving them from place to place, is that not a strategy? Has that ever worked?
It's not a good one. And no, it's never worked. Like, you know, when you talk to older cops, what they would have staked out that area. They would have had eyes on everyone. They would have seen who the dealers were. They would have followed them. They would have found a pretense to pull them over. Mm. They would have gotten their ID. And then instead of announcing 40 arrests but no charges, you have 40 arrests and there are charges.
Right, right, right. Well, we don't know if that might be part of the strategy as well. I mean, there is a command center there. And there was a 24-hour sobering center, right, that got sped up ostensibly to take people to. Are there other things that you guys have seen in your reporting that he's doing on the public safety side that maybe does seem like a difference from Mayor Breed?
Well, I mean, the big thing was that the ordinance that he got passed, which, you know, will allow for accelerated timelines for contracts related to fentanyl use, homelessness, drug addiction, a number of things, and also opens the door for his administration to go out and raise a lot of money from private donors to fund all that work. So that's one thing. But, you know, we're not really going to know what that is translating to on the ground for some time. And I think certainly part of what you're seeing from him right now definitely seems to be an effort to get out in front of that, to do what he's able to do right now while working on the longer term stuff is certainly what he would say. At least.
That is I think JD is right. And that is the best spin. Is that, you know, you just wait. There'll be solutions coming.
Right, right,
and in the meantime, we're setting an example.
Homelessness?
But I will tell you that, with Mayor Lurie, I see potential for things. But, you know, in the first 100 days, I haven't seen the things yet. And it sounds wonky, but the thing I think is the best so far in terms of homelessness and street misery is that the people who are out on the front end for the longest time did not have control over the beds that they could put people into. So you had a disconnect there. Now they are all under the aegis of the same people, so this could be a more coordinated thing.
This is the street team kind of kind of everyone coming together.
And having Kunal Modi as the head of the policy chief in charge of that,
right.
You have a, you know, for lack of a better word, you have bigger silos instead of one silo, and that means that you can actually know where you could put people. The downside to that is you need places to put people,
right.
And they don't have them.
Right,
so Lurie unveiled this plan, Breaking the Cycle, right? And it's about his like different goals around fentanyl, homelessness in 100 days, in 6 months, and in a year. And, you know, some of it will just jump off the page at a journalist, right, as kind of like controversial. But some of the most impactful stuff may be some of the most boring stuff.
Yeah.
Getting agencies to talk to each other, streamlining processes, putting the decisions, as Joe Esk is saying, in the hands of the right people to make the right choices. These are some of the things that are less, I don't know, for lack of a better word, kind of like exciting to present to people in a news story sometimes, but are some of the most impactful and probably some of the most deeply helpful things.
You want to do away with as many situations as possible where someone says, that's not my department.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Just to be clear, what they're talking about, you know, San Francisco used to have something like 9 different street outreach teams that
right.
were ported to a number of different departments. Mayor Lurie has consolidated that so that there are 5 now, and they're more focused on specific neighborhoods. And then there's like a citywide roving team. So the idea there is that it should make things a lot simpler for the city's street outreach. That's one thing that's already happened. I would say another thing that interested me in the Breaking the Cycle thing that you're talking about, Joe F., mm-hmm. is this idea, this hint at the end there that we might get to a point where in the future they start looking at eliminating more of the city bureaucracy, partly by merging the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing back into the Human Services Administration.
So. Well, that brings me to, I want to get your guys' thoughts on the 4 policy chiefs and how you've seen it actually manifest in realities on the ground. But before we do that, I just want to quickly remind everyone that this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW. I'm Manny Akutiel, hosting on a media roundtable. A media roundtable on Mayor Lurie's first 100 days. How do you think he's doing? What do you think he should be focusing on? What worries you about the city? And what do you think is going well? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. The 4 policy chiefs. So who wants to, why don't JD explain what the 4 policy chiefs are, who they are, what they do, and then we can all kind of talk about whether or not we think it's been working well
okay.
after the first 100 days.
So basically, before Mayor Lurie took office, the way that the mayor's administration was structured was that you had this one chief of staff who was the mayor's right-hand person, basically running the day-to-day operations of the city. You know, department heads all pretty much reported up to that one person, who was Sean Ellsburn. Mayor Lurie comes in and says, you know what, rather than having 50-something city departments
55.
All answering to a single chief of staff, I'm going to spread it out more at the top. So he does have a chief of staff, but then he has these 4 policy chiefs, and each of them have different umbrellas of departments that they oversee. So you have a smaller number of departments reporting to each chief. And so you've got Kunal Modi doing the health and homelessness stuff. You've got Paul Yep doing public safety, Alicia John-Baptiste doing transportation and environment and things like that, and then Ned Siegel doing housing and the economy.
So the question is it working? Was it the right thing to do? And how do you think it's going to change the way our city government actually functions?
So I would say this design is a good idea. For first of all, I think that things were bottlenecked in the prior iteration, and we did have quote unquote deputy mayors before under Art Agnos until people voted on it to get rid of it because they were earning an exorbitant amount of money of $90,000 or $80,000 at the time. So now you can have these people and call them something other than deputy mayors, and there is a cap on how much they can earn. And being as our mayor is very, very well paid, that cap is not, it's not a problem to find good people who want to take the job. You know, the mayor earns something like $400,000, so people earning 70% of that are still taking home a lot of money. This is definitely a good way of doing things because it fits well with Daniel Lurie. You know, he's getting the information better this way from people who he trusts and whom are specialists with it. I can see where it could run into problems because people will necessarily kind of become cheerleaders for their causes. They do not report to the chief of staff. They report to him, which puts them all on an even footing, which could be cumbersome. But we'll know how well they work when you know, the excrement hits the air conditioning and the budget situation comes up. We will not know much until then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think, Joe Fitz?
You know, I think it's interesting about this one is this kind of takes care of one of the chief concerns people had about Mayor Lurie when he was candidate Lurie, that this was essentially like his first large-sized job, right? That he wasn't necessarily very experienced in government or politics or even these policy areas that, you know, all these policy chiefs are overseeing, except maybe poverty and homelessness from his experience in Tipping Point. But he, in this case, with the policy chiefs, he doesn't really have to be. He offloads that responsibility to them. And he becomes now the city's biggest cheerleader. You see him on the news trying to invite people back in and businesses back in. His job changes. The mayor's job changes. And that's a smart part of this policy chief thing.
Sorry, I forgot to ask a question that I wanted to before in response to something you said, Joe Eskenazi, which was about first 100 days. And maybe all three of you would agree with this. I don't know if you would. That there's been a lot of aspects where he's addressing these issues that feel like, don't worry, I have a deeper plan later. These are the things that I can do right now. If you believe, if that's how you'd characterize it, how much of that do you think is because he is working with his teams to actually come up with what the real plans are going to be to solve these problems? Or how much of it is you do not believe that he actually has plans, he's not working on it, and he does not know what to do? You are more inside than almost any other San Franciscans. You're talking to people in the administration. You're communicating with your sources. Which of the two would you say is it at this stage of the game?
It depends on the issue. I wouldn't say there's a coherent plan now to get people to come back into offices and have that level of occupancy in downtown. I'd say it's going to be a bloodbath downtown. I'd say that very wealthy people are going to lose their shirts because eventually the rents are going to have to come down. It wouldn't make sense to sooner or later there's going to be a reorganization there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be a node in the punctuated equilibrium, and it's going to be bad. And there's no way to plan for that. You can't change that dynamic.
Okay,
yeah,
so,
I don't think there's a grand plan yet for what to do with what we used to call the Westfield Mall at Market and Fifth Street.
Okay. But they're listening.
And even where he does have a grand plan, you know, he's hitting a bit of a wall. Like, for instance, you know, with the budget, he told departments, hey, you got to cut, you know, 15% out of your budget. And then they have to turn in their proposals to him. Oh, but I think like something like 20 of those departments said, nah, we're good.
Right. Something I can tell you is they're looking and seeing the mayor didn't cut 15% out of his budget. There are more people on staff now, and they're earning more money.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What about to homelessness? I mean, it is probably the issue that like we see and most San Franciscans interface with the most. What have you seen have been the things that he's tried to implement in the first 100 days? And have you heard of any kind of longer-term plan that you think he'd be able to implement?
Well, that's the Breaking the Cycle plan we were referencing earlier. It has that 100-day, 6-month, and 1-year interval. And kind of immediately, it's interesting, you see him kind of taking sides in this kind of debate. We haven't really touched on this, but there's this debate between folks who are kind of pushing what we would call harm reduction strategies, strategies developed during the AIDS crisis of kind of meeting people where they are with drugs, and a more abstinence-based approach. And, you know, he's definitely been swinging more towards that, away from the harm reduction strategies in a big way. And politically, those folks are losing a lot of ground. And that's one of the kind of biggest shifts we're seeing in there.
Okay, we have some emailed questions that I'm going to read from now. One is on homelessness, since we were just talking about it. Regular listener Rick from Citrus Heights.
Up north. Near Sacramento.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I'm like, is that a San Francisco neighborhood that I just don't know about? Sounds tasty. Mm-hmm. Is Mayor Lurie, Daniel Lurie, going to bring back a program started under one of the previous mayors called Project Homeward Bound to reunite homelessness with their families?
So I'm so glad you asked, because all of us have done research on this. They are having a very hard time pushing that one. It's like the fish that no one wants to order at the restaurant that they're pushing and pushing and pushing. Under prior mayors, more than 10,000 people were, you know, bussed out of San Francisco, and the program was more robust than the iteration now. They had to call and make sure that there was someone there to receive you, and they would call and check on you. Now you don't need to have someone there to receive you. And, you know, they told me they want to meet people where they're at, which homeless providers have told me is a irresponsible adoption of that term to make you feel good. You want to meet people where they're at to do some things, but not to put them on a bus when they're having a crisis and this would be a very bad bus ride to be on. And people do not take the ticket. So that, instead of called Homeward Bound, now it's called Journey Homeward.
Got it. We have another, any other one, anyone on the Homeless Bound, Homeward Bound, you want to?
No, I was just going to say, you know, like Joe said, it never went away, but they're trying to revamp it, I think.
It's like Jolt Cola. It's always coming back, but like now it's not nearly as powerful as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Joe Eskenazi with the pop culture references for days, Jolt Cola. A question from Will on the Board of Supervisors. I am curious about how he is working with the Board of Supervisors. In the past, with London B, for example, London B, there's always chatter that the mayor had difficulties making progress due to the Board of Supervisors. Right, everyone was saying like, oh, and the mayor was saying this, I can't do anything because of the Board of Supervisors. Is this the case now?
Well, he started with a much better hand in that regard. So there was a lot of turnover on the Board of Supervisors, an influx of like five or six new supervisors when he started. So it's kind of a different body of people than the prior mayor had to deal with. And it did shift politically to be more in his favor. And I think, you know, his predecessor would have loved to have a board that looks more like the one today than it did when she was in office. However, it does seem like we've been talking about earlier that he is going out of his way to develop really good relationships with people. And that's why you saw like a 10-1 vote on his first major piece of legislation.
Yes, but it also, you know, if we were to be maybe a little, you know, cynical about it, we could be cynical, he's making those relationships now when he doesn't have to, because next year he might have to, because the board could turn over. All of a sudden there could be a progressive majority, people who might not be into Lurie's policies and fight him a little more tooth and nail. Progressives don't really have a lot of leverage right now. If they disagree with what he's going to do, it's a lot harder.
There's no coherent opposition right now to Daniel Lurie, and that's, you know, for all the skill involved in winning the campaign and all the money, which is, you know, not skill, but still it was spent well. That's luck. Is that he has no coherent opposition right now. A goodly number of these supervisors are just learning how to do stuff. They are. And then on top of it, physically and metaphysically, there is no Aaron Peskin on this board to be oppositional.
Just to play devil's advocate, is it possible that there isn't as much organized opposition because people feel like the policies he's pushing are the right ones?
What policies?
The move away from harm reduction, the zoning map that he just came out with, breaking the cycle.
The Board of Supervisors has no say on that zoning map.
Yeah, but bringing together all the different street teams. I don't know, some of the things that he's...
None of these things that would warrant opposition from the board, but even still, there's only so much a board can do. The board's role in this in here is circumscribed. In order to have any kind of, you know, organized pushback against the mayor, it needs to be organized. And all the things you're describing are things that the mayor has the prerogative to do. The mayor, the board doesn't rezone the city. The mayor does, right?
Well, they could have organized against the fentanyl ordinance, the state of emergency, but they didn't organize against that.
They worked with him on that one. And the thing here is that it came out that basically the mayor, when you talk to all the people on the board, there were objectionable elements that were smoothed out, and at this point, it's like, let's see what he's got.
All right, yeah. other opinions here.
And the let's see what he's got, though, kind of, it works in their favor, too, because look at it this way. If you're a progressive supervisor and you give up all your power, you give it all away to Daniel Lurie, as they did, and you say, okay, Daniel Lurie now gets to cut all the red tape. He gets to put all of his plans forward as fast as possible. We've given him every possible power to do it. Once they got out of the way, if he fails, well, then they can say, in a year's time, well, he failed. Now we got to do our thing. Yeah. And if he succeeds, then they can say, we helped him do that. Mm. So either way, the progressives win.
Yeah, and I will say there is one supervisor so far that's been very vocally critical of him, and that's Shimon Walton, who represents the Bayview. Really does not like a plan that the Lurie administration is moving forward with for a sizable expansion of a previously planned homeless shelter there. But so far, Walton has really been the only one to have been that harshly critical of something that Mayor Lurie is trying to do, at least from the Board of Supervisors. But I think there's a chance that it could be a harbinger of possibly what's to come in other neighborhoods, because as we've seen time and time again in San Francisco, any expansion of homeless services in any neighborhood tends to be met with some degree of resistance. Mayor Breed learned that very early on in her term when she, when the city was doing the Embarcadero Navigation Center,
Oh, man, what a meeting. What a meeting.
Shouted down at a meeting then. So we might see more of that because he has said he wants to add 1,500 shelter and treatment beds this year.
Yeah. And the progressives are also really saving their guns because, as you know, Joe and JD have both said, the thing really coming up is the budget. And that's where you're going to need every single bit of political ammo you can stash away.
Why?
Because there could be things that are cut that affect their constituencies. These are things that get them elected. I mean, when the budget time comes around, a lot of these supervisors, as JD was mentioning, are able to kind of work around the margins. They can do what are called ad backs. Oh, I got, you know, a million here for this group or a couple hundred thousand for this group. And it makes them look wonderful.
I can tell you exactly how much money they added back in the last budget was 0.2%.
Wow.
It's so tiny.
By the time that the mayor had passed the budget, 99.8% of the budget was decided. They are fighting over the last 0.2%. And this is the only part of the budgeting process that gets any coverage. It's really unfortunate. So, you know, if you look at the items that are on the ad backs list, it's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars per item. As a point of context, San Francisco spends very neatly, almost $1 million exactly a year on toilet paper. So you're talking about things that are a small fraction of the toilet paper money are the things that people are being judged by. Because if it's your district supervisor, the homeless service in your district wants to know you fought for them. That's important to the district supervisors. As far as the whole city, you know, the budget is very much set by the mayor.
But I will say we've seen in recent years, you know, even though it is just a tiny amount of money, there's when those ad backs come around, when it's time to do that, you know, you really see a groundswell of people coming to the Board of Supervisors mm-hmm. to speak in public comment to different community groups to fight tooth and nail.
Everyone is fighting over that last 0.2%.
As much as they can get. And what I will say is I'm going to be very interested to see what that looks like this year. Mm. If Mayor Lurie, you know, follows through on some of what he said he's going to do, which is some sort of more aggressive right-sizing of the budget there.
I guess
It's code for cuts.
A lot of us were in the room when the first Board of Supervisors meeting happened, and they voted unanimously to have Rafael Mandelman become the president of the board. Mayor Lurie came into the room, congratulated them, and said that it was his hope that this brought in a new era of how San Francisco did government.
No.
That is what he said.
Yes, maybe he said that.
That is what he said. And before
Joe's face. Wait a second.
Who's the moderator here? Before we get into it, I mean, there are going to be challenges where the city is at a time where those challenges are great, maybe the greatest they've been in a while. Do you think that it is possible that a different style of leadership, you called it vibes, could actually manifest in a more collaborative way of getting through these troubled times?
That was an inside deal cut within the board between Myrna Melgar and Rafael Mandelman and a few others in order to just be able to smooth it out in public. And there were, you know, it was all done behind closed doors. And if you want to say that's how it should be, that this was collegial government that had nothing to do with the mayor. So in terms of a board functioning, that is better. And I think it's probably less embarrassing than having 15 rounds of people giving each other a hard time and trying to waylay votes in the woman's room, as happened the last time a board president was elected.
It also has to do with who's actually on the board now and mm-hmm. what those personalities are like.
Everyone's nice to each other until money's on the line.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's the bottom line.
Mm. And it's also, I think, really important to remember just how many of those supervisors were brand new when that vote was taken.
Right.
This was a group of people, half of whom were still, you know, learning how to work with each other. And they still are to a degree.
They're still moving their furniture in. They're cute little baby supervisors.
But we are 100 days in, and we have yet to see, like, one of those big public spats that San Francisco has become famous for. And over the last 5 years, things that we became almost embarrassed about sometimes. So I'm at least hopeful that it's possible that we can move through this without more of that. But
I think collegiality is good, but it's also overrated.
Wow. Hard disagree.
So cynical.
Let's get a couple emails. We have a couple emails on that we got on housing, construction, the tariffs. The tariffs obviously are national news. Email from Nicole. How do you think the mayor will ensure that new housing is actually built given the recent high tariffs and high interest rates? Is there anything he can do to help with that?
I mean, if you looked at the quote in JD's paper from the head of the Residential Builders Association, that's a problem. You can zone up to so high that the building is coming up out of the floor from going through the world. But, you know, if the situation is not there, if people can't get financing, you know, et cetera, then you have a problem. The city is almost like the manager of a baseball team. You're trying to manage as best you can to put people in a position to succeed, but you can't get out there and do it for them.
Right.
You can't hit that pitch. You're the manager. So, you know, we can try and set up a situation that people succeed in, and the zoning was something that was mandated, had to do it. State insists upon it, but we can't make them build.
Mm. Mm. Is there anything that the mayor can do to address these high tariffs or any of these other issues that are making cost of housing so high?
Not really. I mean, the other thing about some people may turn to affordable housing. Well, why doesn't the city build affordable housing? Affordable housing costs an incredible amount of money to build. Either you get the people who are developing homes, which are not happening right now, to pay some fees or to incorporate it into the housing they're building, or the city tries to pay for it itself. And none of those things are really happening right now, especially in this budget deficit that we have right here. So turning to that as
another solution.
The
city can do a lot. I think a way that governing and politics kind of cohese together is that, you know, San Francisco's MO for many years would be, we're going to make things as difficult as possible because we can.
Right.
And that could also be with, you know, the way that you relate to your colleagues in government. Well, that doesn't have to be the case anymore.
Right.
And you know, I don't see things that this mayor can do to goose housing, but something he can certainly do is free up the cumbersome process at in the building department, get rid of the overt corruption and ineptitude there, and there's no downside to that. So, like, you know, there's no downside to that, and when things are a little bit better, then construction will move ahead more clearly.
Yeah, well, I think what a lot of folks in his administration and definitely in Mayor Breed's administration would tell you is that, you know, while they can't control a lot of the macroeconomic factors that are getting in the way of new housing being built, what they were trying to do and have been trying to do is to sort of set the table so that when conditions improve, things can move faster because San Francisco has, like you said, fixed the things that it can control, you know, made its processes more streamlined, you know, made it so that, you know, when the economy is better, San Francisco's processes won't get in the way of things moving forward.
This is kind of like the whole abundance argument now, that we have to show those people that we can govern well and then they won't use us as an example of... That's not true. They're going to find something else to denigrate us with. But you might as well govern well because it's better than governing badly. So just do that.
I don't know, Joe. I mean, the amount of stories about our city's dysfunction that have come out in national press.
You think they need them to be factual?
Yes. I think there needs to be, or at the very least, not give them like fodder to write about.
But that's, I think it's fantastically naive to say that this will cease that and then suddenly they'll go and write about stories about Portland.
But don't you think, like, you know, that could be used as an excuse to not actually
fix
the problems?
We don't need to make an excuse to govern San Francisco well because people in the Midwest, you know, are throwing their TV trays at it while they're watching Fox News in the evening.
Yeah, but we're giving
you might
them,
as well just govern well because it's the right thing to do.
True. But that's different than the argument that our city, it sounds like in your response that we really don't have any problems that need to be fixed. I mean, do you...
No, I'm saying that the notion that if these problems weren't there, San Francisco wouldn't be the avatar of liberal misrule. They will find something else. And it doesn't have to be something fair. It could just be because of inclusiveness or diversity. It doesn't have to be something because of, like, wow, it took me a year to get my ice cream shop's permit.
Well, whatever the reason is, don't you think it should behoove us in this moment to have our government be more functional, that the outcomes of our government should be better? We should have cleaner streets, safer streets, more housing being
absolutely
built, a better public school
the
system?
Standard, my outlet has like a whole like, why can't we have nice things kind of series of things going on of like permit nightmares and fees gone amok. And it's so rampant, it's so easy to find that we could fuel a whole series with examples.
So easy to find that the Chronicle is doing one too. And I think both of our outlets would love for there to be a day when those stories aren't so easy to come by.
Knock our series out. Make our series impossible to do.
There's definitely a growth industry of photos of aggrieved homeowners with their arms crossed in front of a project gone wrong, right? So this is true. But on the other hand, like, we don't need to fix this because of what will people in the Midwest say. You should just fix this because it's better governing.
I mean, yes, and he ran on accountability. Is he achieving that?
I would say, again, the grade is incomplete, and we're going to, you know, the heavy lifting isn't there yet. I would say that when it comes to the 1,500 beds for the shelter bed goal, I was disappointed because one of the allures of Daniel Lurie is that he's not a politician and doesn't do political tricks.
Right.
So, you know, counting beds that were already in the pipeline from London Breed, in fact, you know, a quarter of your goal, that's a political trick. Right. You know,
but
redefining what a shelter bed is, that's a political trick. Changing the timeline, that's a trick.
Oh, man, he shoved that timeline up. First it was, from 6 months from when I was elected. Then it was, it's 6 months from when I passed this policy.
Okay, but he's also not a magician. He can't pull 1,500 beds out of his butt after 100 days. You know what I mean?
But you shouldn't have said you were going to do it then.
Perhaps, but he was running for office. I guess we only have a minute or two left. And in that minute or two, I guess what I would, I guess
a little more.
2 minutes, 3 minutes. Give him a grade. explain to me why you're giving him this grade. What would you grade him right now? All those things considered, everything we just talked about. And then, give him a grade. That's my last question to each of you.
I think what Joe said is right. The incomplete is accurate. We can't really grade him at this point, but I would give him like a little happy face sticker, a little star on his paper for some of the accountability taken he's done, and then I might give him a few red marks for some of the, as Joe said.
Well, Joe here, who actually used to be a teacher, so like he's the expert on the panel. But
No. A plus to F. You have to give him a grade.
Oh, gosh. You can't do that because the thing because the test hasn't come yet. You know, this is just organizing your pens on the desk. The test is coming, and that's the budget.
It's been 100 days of interaction.
He said present, and he raised his hand, and that's about
it. I mean, you get 400 points in the SAT for signing your name. So
I don't think there have been any, like, massive missteps, though.
No.
There was no, like, fall on his face moment. There was no, you know, failing grade.
Everyone was saying—
Even his opening day pitch was pretty good.
All of you guys said in your papers— that the risk with Daniel Lurie is that when he becomes mayor, he's not going to know where the light switch is to turn on. He's not going to be able to govern. He's not going to be able to do anything. He's a neophyte. And is that what's happened? Has that come to fruition? Or have you been pleasantly surprised? Or do you really feel like you haven't been given enough information to actually make an estimation of what kind of mayor he's going to be?
I think that there have been problems like that, but they're getting smoothed out. On the other hand, you know, this is not a test. It is not clear to me that this administration fully grasps the difference between an enterprise department and a general fund department. And, you know, I would say that these are problems that will manifest themselves more moving forward. I think Joe's synopsis of it is a good one. There's a lot of potential there. I see a lot of potential. And, you know, I've seen a few things that give me pause, but I see a lot of potential. And on top of it, let's go back to the very beginning. This is a mayor who is not denigrating the city for political gain. It's a low bar, but that's important. That's what people wanted, and that's what this city needed.
The other thing I will point out is that the main thing he did was, you know, he brought in these new policy chiefs. Obviously, the people that work in his office are very different. He replaced the, there's a new transportation director and a new director of public health. Otherwise, the people running the city are still the same people that were running the city last year.
I think the biggest lasting way that you can grade him is what changes does he make that will outlive him. One of the biggest worries I have with his kind of pitch to raise money to get government to work is who besides Daniel Lurie, Tipping Point director, can raise those kinds of funds to get the city on the right track? When he's out of here, can the next mayor who's not, you know, a Levi Strauss heir with tons of wealthy connections make the connections necessary to raise the money the way he's doing? Or is that a one-time thing?
And the other point here is that I was a little bit taken aback that they didn't have a project in mind when they mentioned this. Like, it's still conjectural, you know, so I see potential there, but like, what are you going to do?
Well, I guess the four of us will have to come back together with the next mayor after their 100 days and see, give them the grade. Thank you so much, all three of you. We could have done this for hours and hours and hours. We barely scratched the surface of so many things. We didn't talk about the Development Corporation, the Partnership for San Francisco, Westfield Mall. We will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Truly, truly, San Francisco, you are lucky. You are you have a riches of journalists here in the city. Joe Eskenazi of Mission Local, an embarrassment of riches. J.D. Morris of the San Francisco Chronicle, and Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez of the SF Standard. Thank you so much, you guys.